Welcome to episode 13 of Open Source Underdogs, the podcast where we help open source software entrepreneurs metamorphize their business models. Jay Kreps is the co-founder and CEO of Confluent, the company behind Apache Kafka, a real-time stream processing platform currently used by 35% of the Fortune 500. This episode is being recorded remotely because Jay is based in Silicon Valley. Jay, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So it's not every day that the company you're working for agrees to let you start a company to work full-time on a project you started while working for them. How'd this come about?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there was actually a whole kind of evolution of the infrastructure stack at LinkedIn where I had worked. You know, we rebuilt a lot of the database layers that served the kind of live site, and we had built custom stores for searching for people, you know, the search infrastructure and for the social graph that shows how you're connected to people. It was kind of a time in the world where all the infrastructure was moving from single server databases and systems to these distributed systems that could scale horizontally. And that was incredibly important for a social network like LinkedIn, because it had to scale in some sense faster even than the number of users. It in some ways scales almost with the square of the users, because you have all their connections and interactions between them, and that kind of grows faster than just the people joining. We were really trying to figure out, how can you scale a social network, and how can you do it in a way that's cost efficient, and how can you, you know, not just make it able to handle the data size, but actually make it something where you can have hundreds or thousands of engineers that kind of work against these platforms productively. How can it all kind of interrelate? And so the genesis of Kafka was really that environment. We had all these different stores. We had all these big aspirations for how we wanted to use what was happening kind of in real time and feed it back into the user experience, how we wanted to connect all these different systems, in some sense, how it would all plug together. And there was really no solution to that problem that we felt was, you know, well thought out or could scale in that way. And so we really started to think about, like, hey, what's missing in this stack? And, you know, we came to some interesting observations. Like, a lot of the traditional data processing technology is something that almost comes out of the mainframe era, where kind of at the end of the day, you load everything up into some big data warehouse or Hadoop cluster, and then you run these big processing jobs that kind of spit out results, you know, hours later. And we thought, you know, it doesn't really make sense. Like, for a big global digital business, all your data is continuous. And when you say, oh, we run all our processing at the end of the day, it's not even clear, like, the end of what day. And so we kind of thought, hey, there could be a model for this where, instead of taking all this data and bringing it all together once 24 hours later, just do it all the time, kind of model everything that was happening as a kind of continuous stream of data and allow real-time applications that would continually process that as it occurs. And if you did that, you could really feed that back so that you could have news feeds that update right away, and the interaction could be much, much richer and more real-time. And this could be kind of the basis for connecting all these different systems, for connecting all these different applications that would connect around these streams of data. So we looked at the academic literature, and there had been some stuff in this area, but it had kind of fizzled out. Then we looked at kind of the commercial space, and there really hadn't been much. And there was kind of old messaging systems and other layers, but nothing really good in the area in the way that databases had been developed. A lot of theory and thought into them. Yeah, that was the origin of it. And then we started building. We spent really in the order of about 5 years building Kafka and scaling it so it would really handle at LinkedIn all the activity of, hey, what are the actions people are doing? What's happening right now? All the changes coming into databases. It could really be that kind of central nervous system that connects everything. And we open sourced it in that time, and it ended up, you know, really becoming popular in Silicon Valley. A lot of the big tech companies, the Pinterests and Ubers and Netflixes, really took this and built around it as really a core part of their platform. As that happened, we started to come into contact with a broader world. For me, I'd only really work in Silicon Valley tech companies. And so I didn't really know a lot about how a bank is built and operates, or a big retailer is built and operates. But as we started to talk to these companies, we got a sense for, hey, the applications for this could be much bigger even than what's happening so far. That this could really be at the heart of all the companies in the world. This could be really the central thing that they kind of all build around. When we realized that, we thought, hey, you know, what do you need to do to make that happen? Because a lot of these companies just couldn't adopt what we had as kind of a, hey, download this from GitHub and go put it into practice. They needed a lot more. And so we realized, you know, look, there'd have to be some company that would go fund development on this and try and really turn it into a product, turn it into a service, and take it out into the world. And when we realized that, we put some thought into how to do it. And then we told people at LinkedIn that we would be leaving. You know, it was actually a really nice thing. Rather rather than being unhappy about it, they actually offered to invest and kind of help us on our way. So in addition to kind of raising majority of our funding from traditional venture capitalists, we took a little bit of investment from LinkedIn, which kind of helped us get started.
It's amazing. You don't hear it very often that company is so supportive, but I guess they knew firsthand how powerful it was.
Yeah, it was actually an interesting part of their culture that they believed in kind of entrepreneurship, and they believed that in the modern world, you don't come and work someplace forever. And you know, I'd been there for 7 years. So I was there really from when it was pretty small to when it was quite large. And then they believed in kind of helping people, you know, as the time comes to go do the next thing. That was kind of the cultural values. And I thought it was pretty cool that they actually acted on that, that they were, you know, willing to kind of back it up when push comes to shove.
So it's one thing to have an open source project with lots of adoption and excitement, and another thing to start a business that generates millions in revenues. So the company started in 2014, and I read a press release that said that the first commercial product was launched in May of 2016. Can you talk a little bit about the experience of going from an open source project to a commercial offering?
It's actually an interesting thing. Like, there's really two main ways of commercializing open source. And I actually think for most open source projects, they don't really need a company, and they actually won't really support a company in an easy way. So if you kind of go to GitHub, there's probably some millions of repositories there. I think most of those would not succeed as a standalone company. You kind of need something where, you know, it's popular enough and there's enough depth to the problem that people kind of want ongoing work and effort and support and service. And so it's worked pretty well for these core data systems and platforms. It's not the case that it actually works for every kind of little library. And we felt strongly that there was an opportunity in the area we were in, even though there wasn't really an existing example of any kind of open source company in that space, because what we're doing is data system, but it's not a traditional database. We started, the first debate was really whether we wanted to start with a hosted service in the public cloud, or whether we wanted to start with a software offering that people could run in their own data centers, but that they would have to run. So would we do something that was fully managed, or would we do something that was more of a software product? You know, we actually thought a lot about this. We came out of the world of really running the software at LinkedIn. Like, we built it, but we also operated it. And so it was pretty attractive to build an as-a-service offering. Eventually, in thinking about this, we realized you have to do both. And it's just a question of how you sequence them. And we ended up starting with the software offering because we realized for a lot of companies, that's kind of where they were. And they were kind of already adopting the open source. So that was a nice transition to be able to use the commercial features if that was useful. And so we did that. And then about a year ago, we released our as-a-service offering that's in the public cloud. And both of those, you know, we kind of target for the software offering, we target kind of an open core model where there's a, you know, set of enterprise features beyond the open source, and you get also support across all of it. For the cloud offering, it's, you know, it's pretty much the same thing, but you actually get it run for you. So you don't have to develop the expertise and staff to do that.
When I was looking at some of the diagrams of the Confluent platform, I was wondering if it was more of a tools business model similar to cloud era, or if it was open core. Is it sort of the same thing to you, or do you differentiate a little bit between those?
I think one question that, at least in my mind, has been answered is, you're building a business around open source. Do you need to have any kind of commercial IP as part of the offering? You know, do you want to have any software that's not open source? Or is it better to do a pure open source offering? And I think the finding has been, it is definitely better to have some kind of commercial offering that isn't purely open source. And you want to find a way to do that that doesn't kill all the attractiveness of an open source platform. The whole reason people want these open platforms is they have such an amazing ecosystem around them. There's no lock-in. Those are the huge advantages. And so you don't want to ruin that as you think about how to commercialize it. And you don't want to poison the community. Or you really want to most support the and enrich the open source community rather than stifle it. And so, to me, that's the finding. I don't differentiate much between kind of open core or proprietary tools around the side. I mean, to me, that's all. You're looking for a commercial offering that kind of supports the open source.
Kafka is Apache licensed because it's an Apache project, but how did you license the other pieces of the Confluent platform?
Yeah, so we do both. We have an open source part of the offering. For example, KSQL is a layer where you can take the streams of data coming into Kafka and you can do SQL queries on top of them. And that's open source. So you can download it and use it. And then, you know, for a lot of the management or monitoring or operational features that kind of allow you to connect up between data centers or run the stuff at scale, we built those as commercial software, which, you know, has a proprietary license that's part of our offering. And so the way that that's sold is you buy the service, you're basically paying for your use of the service. And we kind of meter that use by the data that flows through it or that's stored. And if you buy the software, we do that as a subscription that is priced by the number of nodes that the software is on. Both of those are roughly usage-based models that are subscriptions. And I think that's actually a great model for companies like us. Like, it means our incentive is to make sure you're getting value out of the software, that you're using it, and that you're getting value out of us, and that you're able to use it more, that it grows as a platform within the company and more applications are able to come on and take advantage of it.
Were there any challenges around figuring out what item you were going to actually gate on? What was the right pricing model for that? Did you get it right initially, or did you have to adjust it a couple times?
Some of the things we got right and some we didn't. You know, it's interesting you say that. Yeah. So for these, you know, kind of hybrid offerings where it's open source, but there's also commercial features, I think they have an element of a kind of freemium offering. And so that's actually really common outside of open source even. And so, you know, I'd come from LinkedIn previously, and parts of LinkedIn's business had that model where they had basically a free offering, which is probably most people's experience of LinkedIn.com. And then you could get a professional account. And then they have really a full enterprise software product for sales and recruiting that's, you know, totally different from the main site and experience and is geared towards users in those domains. And so it's very much kind of a freemium model where you can come and you can get a fair amount of value, even if you don't pay. But for many of the people who are, they can get even more value if they kind of upgrade to one of those tiers and they kind of target different users for it. And so, yeah, you have tension in any of those. You have tension in any of those models because if you gave everything away for free, that would kind of be, you know, your users would be the happiest, but you also would have no business. And if you kind of kept everything back, you would have more to sell. But actually, that whole basis of users and the whole set of people who are getting this and building around it and kind of growing into something where they would get value from the commercial features wouldn't exist. And so I think it's actually a bit tricky to draw that line right, but it's actually very powerful for companies that can, because they're able to basically create a lot of value in the world. And even though they're not capturing all of it, they can capture quite a lot, right? In open source, some of these infrastructure layers are so powerful that, you know, even if you're only capturing 10 or 20% of the value you're creating, that's still quite substantial. And I think that's actually, in many ways, the hallmark of a lot of these software-driven businesses is very much that. If you look at Facebook or any of these kind of internet services, they have a similar dynamic where, in some sense, if you think about the raw time people spend on them, they don't make that much money in comparison, but the scale is so vast that they're still making a lot of money in absolute terms.
What are the range of customers who convert into Confluent platform customers?
Yeah, we've got companies of all kinds, huge car companies that are doing these amazing connected car projects where they're connecting all the cars that they sell to the internet and adding all these software features around that and internet services. They kind of power stuff in the cars. Big banks that are kind of rebuilding all their core infrastructure and trading platforms and risk systems and security and fraud analytics. Big retailers that are doing kind of real-time inventory management. So really across the board. And we've seen that from kind of small companies to, you know, some of the largest companies in the world. So definitely the kind of time that it's right to talk about any kind of commercial offering is when people are getting real value. You know, I think one of the things that was wrong with a lot of the commercial infrastructure platforms is that when a new platform comes around and you evaluate it, you end up quite tied to the platform over time. And so for something that's new and kind of unproven and proprietary, you're going to be hugely tied to it. And it's not really taking off in the world yet. And so you saw so many of those platforms kind of fail to ever achieve escape velocity. And I think open source really solves that for these new platforms. People can do development against it. You know, they can download it, do development against it, really understand how it works, put it into place for less important applications, all without really spending any money. So the risk is pretty low. And then as it becomes something that's generating a lot of value for them, there can be offerings that really make a lot of sense where they're interested in paying more to get more. And so a lot of this kind of failure to thrive that you saw in so many commercial infrastructure platforms, because people, it just wasn't worth the lock-in and betting so big on a small vendor, is kind of really overcome by open source. And I think that's why you see so many of the really popular infrastructure platforms of all types are open in that way.
So in your customer base, do you segment at all?
I really found there's two dimensions that matter, small companies to large companies, and less technically sophisticated to more technically sophisticated. Of course, there's companies in all of those segments that use the product in different ways, and their kind of needs and preferences are different. So you think about the small technically sophisticated companies. I would say that's Silicon Valley, but also New York and parts of Europe, tech startup scene. What they want is a hosted service. They don't want to buy software. They don't want to run stuff. They just want, to be able to use these services dynamically, pay for what they use, and go. Large, technically sophisticated companies, they're looking to, they have substantial on-premise footprints. They need something that spans both environments. They need to be able to run the software in their data centers, but also in the cloud and connect all that up and stream data back and forth and kind of get something that works across all the environments they're in. I would say small, non-technical companies, we don't end up working with them much just because they don't really need what we're doing yet.
Amazon has a service. It's using Kafka. You've probably seen MongoDB and Redis have adjusted their license to prevent large cloud providers from competing with them in a way that doesn't support the community. Have you thought about perhaps forking Kafka and providing it under a different license to enable you to capture more value from some of the large cloud providers who might be deploying it and benefiting from it without really contributing back a fair amount?
Yeah, it's definitely been an issue where the public cloud is so new that kind of the dynamics of how you manage an offering there are still emerging. A lot of the assumptions that went into how open source is licensed really predate that. They come from a world where the way software was delivered was it was shipped to you. Obviously, that's been untrue for, the kind of cloud applications where it's like a UI app like Salesforce for a while. But the new thing is that these kind of infrastructure as a service, the ability to get a database, the ability to get these kind of back-end infrastructure pieces, which is typically the domain of open source, to be able to get that as a service. Open source licenses haven't come to maturity in that time. And so I think for a lot of these companies, they're kind of going through a struggle trying to figure out what's the right balance. How much should be make freely available to anyone who wants it, even if they want to create a competing service and not contribute? And how much should we not do that? I think the balance people mostly want is that they actually want, it's actually fair for your customers to kind of take the software and not pay. Right? That's kind of the deal that I think you want with open source. You want people to be free from lock-in to the vendor, and that's a big part of the value. It's unclear that you want to basically fund a ton of R&D for Amazon, who should be able to afford to contribute as well if they want to have an offering like this. So I think people are trying to figure out the right way to adapt to that and do it in a way that's community-friendly and that kind of accomplishes the goals of the company and actually just allows the communities to thrive. And I don't think there's any kind of final answer to how to do it, or not one that we know yet, but it'll be interesting to see how it evolves.
What's the value proposition for Confluent customers? Why do they use the Confluent platform versus a platform or one of your competitors, or just the open source, I guess?
There's a couple of things that they're looking for. I mean, a big part of that is how do you take one of these big, scalable, distributed platforms and really make it production ready and really be able to operate it at scale and be able to develop on top of it. Both for our cloud offering and our software offering, that's a lot of what we're helping people do is really make it real. And so when we work with companies, everything we do with them is really structured around that. We have commercial features, we have open source features, we have support, we have consulting to just advise people on how to do stuff and help them get set up. We have training to help them learn how to do it. All of that, though, is really just aimed at this, hey, how can we take a company that doesn't have this technology, and how can we get them started on it? And then how can we make their initial applications successful? And then how can we turn it into really a platform that more and more applications can be built on, so it becomes this kind of fundamental central nervous system that connects all their stuff? And so all of our offerings are actually just aimed around that. The value proposition is very much that. How can we get from point A, where we don't have this capability, to point B, to point C, to point D, where it's this amazing capacity that we build around? And that's kind of what we help companies do at a really high level. And the way we do that is obviously through all these mechanisms, right? So if you're getting it as a service, then you don't have to kind of build all the expertise in-house. If you're getting the software, then it makes the people who are standing this up and operating it a lot more efficient. There's a lot less that they would have to kind of build in-house to do that.
What's the primary channel for getting new customers? Do they find the open source and then they call you, or what's a typical sales cycle look like?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the problem that open source solves from a marketing point of view for infrastructure platforms is basically that. If you think about these kind of big, complex, distributed layers in a company, you don't put them in or take them out very often. And so you really want it to be the case that people are aware of what you do. They're aware of the value that, in a sense, you're kind of a default choice and solution, and that they kind of call you when they're thinking about doing some change there. And so you want, in kind of go-to-market speak, would be called, you know, an inbound sales model. And you want that to be as much of your funnel as possible. If you try and do it the other way, where you kind of go door to door looking for people who might want to make this change and educating them about what you do, it's actually pretty expensive, right? Because you'll find that even if you find a lot of people who are interested, it's just not the right time. And the right time may not be for some years. So you end up with these enormous sales cycles and, you know, really high sales costs to actually get initial deal done. And then they still have to grow the platform to scale internally. And so by working in an open source model, you can kind of turn that around where they kind of come to you there. They can take the open source, they can use it as they're getting value out of it and thinking about like, hey, we're taking some production applications here. That's when they would maybe be interested in talking to you and understanding the value proposition you have. And so that's the advantage it has from a commercial point of view to have an open source offering.
I saw a press release from 2016 that you brought on a director of marketing and a director of sales. What's been the impact of formalizing the sales and marketing functions?
To scale go-to-market activities, you obviously need that, right? So we have a full management team that covers everything you'd expect from CFO, chief revenue officer, chief marketing officer. You kind of need the full set of disciplines that you would expect to be able to actually scale the go-to-market activity. And that's been super important for us.
Have you been working with channel partners, and what role have channel or distribution partners played for developing the sales channels?
If you think about what we do, we're all about taking these streams of data in a company and being able to connect everything up. And so there's a bunch of ways that we work with partner companies. One is with technologies that we can just plug in so that they can get these streams of data. So analytics layers, security layers, databases, all the different types of things that might either be a source or a sink for these streams of data. The other way that we work with partners is SIs. So people who come and help companies do development. They often specialize in industry verticals and they really know the big projects in a company. And so they can kind of help take a new exciting technology like our platform and they can help to apply it in these companies to the problems that are kind of top of mind in that industry, which may be very, very industry specific. There's a ton of value in that and it helps to get leverage and scale. And then we partner also with the cloud providers in different ways in selling our cloud offering. So all of those are important ways that the partnerships kind of help drive the business.
What's your philosophy about building the team? Do you try and keep everyone geographically close? And how do you find people and what are you looking for?
That's a great question. I think ultimately for a company like this, company is the team. There's no other big asset that the company has. There's no factories or machines that you've bought. It's really just a group of people who are really passionate about making something happen in the world. And so all the energy has to go into making that set of people the right people and make sure that they're motivated and the teams can all work together. In terms of geographic separation or consolidation, yeah, we've gone kind of the distributed model. We have offices in Palo Alto, in London, in Munich, Paris, other parts of the US, increasingly in APAC, but we actually take remote employees as well. On the engineering side, in the sales side, we often go into territories with salespeople who are in their territory. And we found that works really well. You have to build the company to support it and to work that way, but it allows you access to the best people in the world. And one of the advantages we've had is people all over the world who are really passionate about what we're doing, you know, want to be part of it, but they don't necessarily want to move to the Bay Area for lots of reasons. So fundamentally, the choice you're making if you're building a company is either I want the best people in the world, or I want the best people that are within an hour drive of my office. And there is a difference between those two things. There's a lot of value in having people kind of all in the same building, but there's a lot of value in having the best people in the world too. And so we chose the latter. And yeah, I don't think we've looked back on it.
So there's a million features you probably want to build for both open source and the commercial. How do you prioritize the work in terms of what goes into open source and what goes into commercial and how much effort do you spend on each?
You know, we have kind of a vision in the space. And so I guess a lot of what we do is oriented around that. Our vision is really that you could have something very much like what databases have been for static tables of data. You could have that for these continuous streams. And so you could really build a company around this stream of events of what's happening. And so all of our efforts are kind of oriented around making that happen. So we're either building up the stack and trying to add the SQL layers and interfaces that make it really easy to work with the streams. We're building core infrastructure that allows us to scale better and work across data centers and provide more fault tolerance and scalability and redundancy, or we're building the kind of cloud and operational tool sets that make it easy to get this stuff or run it in your own data center. And so kind of all of those are really just organized around that same mission. In terms of what's commercial and what's not, we target a operational value proposition, like I said. So the features kind of fall in that bucket. We usually see, hey, is this something that would make a compelling commercial feature? And if not, we make it open source.
But maybe just to push you on that a little bit, there's probably 100 in both categories. How do you decide how much to invest in open source versus commercial?
We don't actually target a percent. I would say our percent of open source development is quite high. So, and you know, it's not because we've managed to a particular percent. What we look at is like, hey, for these commercial features, what do we need to do to make them really compelling? And then in terms of our overall opportunity, what do we have to do to get there? When we think about what makes a good open source feature, it's the layers that people are building against that their applications are going to be committed to. That I think people actually don't want. You know, they don't want to be tied down. They don't want to be locked in. And so those things are inherently open source. They're part of the open source development. So we really think about it that way. You know, we want to make sure we have a good commercial feature set that's worth paying for, but we don't really target a percentage of developer hours one way or the other.
Do you have any closing advice for those entrepreneurs who are just getting started in open source?
I think the open source businesses work well when there's kind of some depth to the problem and where you're really building a platform that other things will build around. So I think that, you know, the computer industry just loves open standards of all kinds. x86, the operating system layers, all of these things have been these kind of created these platforms and ecosystems that people could build around. And it's turned out that open source is a great way of building that kind of platform. So, you know, the internet, maybe it's built around TCP/IP, but not everything can be a protocol. x86, I don't even know the right way to describe what it is, but not everything is an instruction set. And for everything else, I think we found that the best way to build kind of an open platform is open source. That tends to have the best ecosystem. It tends to have all the right feature set over time. Those are the areas where I think it makes sense. I think when people target some kind of point-wise solution or application that's kind of limited in scope and not really a platform in any way, I actually think open source tends to not win out in those domains. When people talk about something that's going to be a platform, many applications or systems will be built around that will have an ecosystem of other tools and integrate with it. That's where open source seems to dominate. So I would look for those opportunities, and I would look for an area where there's going to be enough value that the important thing is to become kind of ubiquitous. And even though you may not capture all the value as a company, you can still be incredibly successful. And I think if you pick those areas, that's kind of where I think open source companies can really thrive. And then, of course, all the difficulties of building a company still apply, right? All the hard things you have to do, it doesn't get you out of any of those. But it does solve some of those problems in go-to-market that I described, both how you find customers, how and what you sell to them, and so on. And I think that can be really helpful.
Jay, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on this.
Yeah, my pleasure. It was wonderful to talk.
That's it for episode 13. Special thanks to the Confluent team for helping us coordinate with Jay. Transcription and episode audio can be found on opensourceunderdogs.com. Music from Broke for Free, Chris Zabriskie, and Lee Rosevier. Production assistance and transcription by Natalie Lau. Operational support from William Lau. Follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @FossPodcast. That's FOSS Podcast. Next week, we're publishing one of the interviews we've been looking forward to since the start of this project. Mark Shuttleworth, founder and CEO of Canonical, the company behind Ubuntu Linux. Don't miss it. Until then, thanks for listening.